This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, rescue efforts pick up in earthquake rocked Afghanistan and Pakistan. More migrants beat a path to the cities. A new push to adopt and honor U.S. military dogs begins.
These guys right here are life-saving and life-changing. So for somebody to abuse an animal, you're stopping somebody else from changing their lives.
A world-famous Chinese pianist brings his talents to the kids. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Rescuers are working feverishly to reach remote areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan rocked by Monday's 7.5 magnitude earthquake that killed more than 300 people and injured more than 2,200 others in both countries. The quake struck sparsely populated areas of northern Afghanistan, and the toll is the worst in Pakistan's northwest. Speaking with International Edition host Susan Yaki, reporter Ayaz Gul in Islamabad says people are breathing a sigh of relief because the overall damage does not appear to be as bad as in the past.
I was able to travel through four towns that were supposed to be the worst affected areas. What I have seen in these four areas that there are, you know, damages to houses, but they are scattered like maybe one in 10 houses got some damage. But that too was because of heavy rain that was taking place prior to the earthquake. So the good news for the region was that it was a very strong earthquake, but because of the depth of the quake, experts now are saying that the damage that is not visible and that is not there is because the earthquake was really deep, and that is why especially that mountainous terrain where the earthquake struck, people are really lucky that there was less damage as compared to what was being expected and what Pakistan had witnessed 10 years ago.
I was going to ask you, this area is frequently hit by earthquakes. Was there a chance to fully recover from previous quakes before this latest quake?
Well, there has been criticism because the damage that was caused by the previous quake was so extensive that it took Pakistan a few years with the help of international community to even complete the rescue work because it was really a massive earthquake at that time, and the damage was, it covered a vast area that where, towns after towns were flattened. So that was the worry, that this earthquake had exactly the same magnitude, and people were just so scared from the previous quake that at the moment this thing happened, everybody was anticipating and was predicting that it's going to be the same kind of situation when the people wake up next morning.
What about supplies and rescue efforts for those who have been victims of this earthquake, the most recent one? Is there enough?
Yes, obviously, because Pakistan, after the previous earthquake, had put in place certain institutions and mechanisms that it was ready to deal with any calamity. And obviously, the scale of this earthquake is not that big. So there's quite a massive rescue effort taking place. But as I said, the preparedness was good enough to deal with a major disaster, but in this case, authorities have been able to manage so far.
Reporter Ayaz Gul speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. Aid officials say getting assistance to all of the quake-stricken areas will take time. The Taliban issued a statement urging aid agencies to not hold back in their work and ordering the group's fighters to, in their words, lend their complete help to the victims. Turning now to the world of social media, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with the latest. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
G, what's the latest?
As you know, the third Republican debate is scheduled to start later today, so let's take a look at how the contenders are prepping for the debate. And of course, we start with Donald Trump. He's on Twitter at @RealDonaldTrump and tweeted this, I am leaving for Sioux City, Iowa. Great event and rally. That's been retweeted about 800 times and marked as a favorite nearly 2,000 times.
Trump loves to share his supporters' tweets and poll results in his favor. Is there anything like that to report today?
Sure. Here's one. He shared a link to a PR Newswire article and tweeted, Trump's national lead increases to 35.6% going to the third GOP debate. It's Trump, Carson, and Rubio.
That must be nice for Trump. But what are the other two tweeting ahead of the big event?
Well, Ben Carson, who is on Twitter at RealBenCarson, shared a picture of him with UFC fighters at the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Underneath the photo, he wrote, a little pre-debate preparation with former UFC light heavyweight champion Victor Belfort and team. Great sparring partner. But Ray, I don't think he actually sparred with Belfort because even in the photo, he's wearing a suit and a tie.
Well, you can always do a little Photoshop on that. But what about Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush? What are they up to?
Marco Rubio tweeted this. Tomorrow is the third GOP debate. RT, that means retweet if you're ready for a new American century. And Jeb Bush took a scenic hike with war veterans and also shared some photos. Here's what he wrote as a caption. The best way to prepare for the hashtag GOP debate. A morning hike at El Dorado Canyon State Park with veterans.
How popular is that hashtag and what will be on the agenda?
The Topsy Analytics website shows that hashtag GOP debate was used in around 2,500 tweets in the last 24 hours. As for the agendas for the debate, I think it's mainly going to be taxes and jobs. Ray?
Thank you, G. You can follow her on Twitter at GABBYLEY. That's spelled JEEABBEYLEE. And also by following our program's account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new report shows increasing numbers of migrants moving to cities around the world to take advantage of the many opportunities urban centers offer. The International Organization for Migration's World Migration Report 2015 focuses on both the risks and opportunities created by the rate of fast urbanization. Lisa Schlein has details.
More than half of the world's population lives in cities. Demographers expect the current urban population of 3.9 billion to grow to an estimated 6.4 billion by 2050. That means nearly 70% of the global population will be living in urban areas. The International Organization for Migration reports migration is driving much of the increase. It says most of the movement to big cities happens within countries and not as a consequence of people seeking a better life abroad. The latest statistics show there are an estimated 230 million international migrants and more than 740 million internal migrants. The report's editor-in-chief, June Lee, says one in seven people on the planet is on the move, with most heading for big cities within their own country. She says most of the migrants do not have the right to legally reside in their national urban centers. She says they resort to irregular means, which makes them vulnerable to exploitation. Lee says the migrants usually live in informal settlements and work in black market jobs where they live in fear of being discovered and are open to abuse.
They still make living, find opportunity for employment and income, and also protection they're coming away from. Disaster, possibly, and political instability back home. So they find, nonetheless, protection opportunity in their harsh environment. Therefore, it is very difficult to stop.
Lee says about 85% of more than 100 countries surveyed by the United Nations have policies in place to halt urban migration. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Norwegian Refugee Council warns that another 100,000 Syrians have been displaced in the weeks since the Russian military intervention. And that's adding enormous pressure on regional refugee camps. International Edition's Victor Beatty has more.
The Council's Secretary General Jan Egeland says the exodus is part of the intensification of military attacks. He says women, children, and the elderly are being killed or forced to flee. He said he's sick and tired of armed men and actors who have for 4 years promised military solutions in the Syrian crisis. I spoke with Council official Carl Shembri, who is in Amman, Jordan. He says more than 13 million Syrian people are in need of aid, a million more than last year, while more than 6.5 million are displaced, nearly half of them children.
We have staff inside Syria who are working day and night and risking their life just to reach in some of the hardest places. And they have informed us that they are feeling the worst, one of the largest displacements in the recent past in Syria. They are worried that they won't be able to cope with the needs, the growing needs that keep growing every day. They told us that they've even seen people carrying their elderly parents over their backs as they fled from the areas and trying to reach safer areas. The problem is that the places that they can access are actually already overstretched, and they are already hosting thousands of other displaced Syrians who were displaced earlier on.
Carl, where are these people coming from mostly?
Mostly they are fleeing from Aleppo. There have also been a surge in fighting around Hama and Idlib, those governorates. The people we know in this case of a massive displacement are heading towards the Turkish border on the outskirts of Idlib.
Are these people who normally you thought might leave because of the ongoing fighting that seems to go on and on, or is this because of the Russian intervention?
Well, the fighting keeps going on from all sides, and we've seen a surge from every armed group over the last 3 weeks. The truth is that Syria is becoming completely unlivable, and thousands keep fleeing from every part of the country. The current surge that we have seen is extremely worrying because we are already at beyond full capacity in catering for the needs inside Syria. Just let me remind your public that over the last years, now 5 years into the Syria crisis, the needs inside Syria for displaced people have increased 13-fold. 13 million is the latest need, the $30 million, which are completely unmet by the donor funding that we are receiving.
A UN representative indicated that Russia's intervention in Syria is facilitating President Bashar al-Assad's war on civilians. Is he actually targeting civilians, in your view?
Well, as a humanitarian agency, we do not track the actual attacks. What I can say is that civilians are the ones who are bearing the brunt of this war. This is civilians and civilian infrastructure that we keep seeing all the time coming under fire from all sides, from every side. We've seen hospitals, schools, houses, women and children coming under fire. They are the ones who are carrying the brunt of this war.
That's Carl Shembri of the Norwegian Refugee Council speaking earlier with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair's in the news. He's apologized for what he calls mistakes made during the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. In an interview with CNN, Mr. Blair also cited military intervention as a trigger for current conflicts in the region, including the rise of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. But he did not fully apologize for the war. International Edition's Jim Stevenson talked with Laura Beers, associate professor in the Department of History at American University here in Washington, for more perspective on the Blair comments.
He gave legitimacy to the invasion in the United States, I think, particularly. Many who were ambivalent about going into Iraq saw the support that the British government was giving George W. Bush's administration and their role in the invasion as the kind of crucial decider in getting behind the war.
In his quotes, he said that he could apologize for the fact that the intelligence they received was wrong, even though that Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons extensively against his own people and others. That's not what they found when they went in.
I think the thing is that I think that Blair doesn't regret having gone in and having removed Saddam Hussein. I don't think he even particularly regrets that he had to mislead the British people in order to get them to go behind him. I mean, I think he thinks that going into Iraq was the right thing. I think he regrets the fact that he became hugely unpopular as a consequence of the Iraq war. I think he regrets the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction has really tarnished his reputation and has hurt the Labor Party and essentially contributed to keeping labor out of power for the last decade. So those things I think he regrets, and I think he sort of feels bad that the intelligence, which I don't even know whether or not he believed at the time, has proved inaccurate.
The Prime Minister seemed to have a real conviction about going into Iraq.
To a degree, that was religiously inspired, not in the sense of some sort of holy war, but in the more basic sense of he has a sort of strong moral center, and he saw Saddam Hussein as a bad man. He saw his regime as bad for the people of Iraq, and for him it was a very black and white issue that this was a bad leader who it was for the good of the world to have removed from power.
Blair also acknowledged that there were some elements of truth in the view that the 2003 invasion of Iraq was also the principal cause in the rise of ISIS, and that too would have a big political impact at home.
Yes, particularly in that the new leader of the Labor Party, Jeremy Corbyn, is much more hesitant about any kind of involvement, not just Iraq, but in the Middle East more broadly, particularly any American-led efforts at regime change or state building, which he sees as kind of foredoomed to failure and also as sort of modern American imperialism. And so the shift within Tony Blair's own party about what can be achieved in the Middle East by Britain and the United States and what perhaps Britain and the United States should even be thinking about trying to achieve has shifted radically in the last decade. And I think Blair is trying to mend some fences or at least sort of bridge some gaps between him and the party as it now stands.
Defense Secretary Ash Carter suggested that the United States will be sending troops to Iraq and Afghanistan in the future. Has the Iraq invasion and the aftermath of it and what is being talked about now affected the U.S.-British relationship in the sense that a partnership may be a little bit more difficult to maintain in that arena?
I think there's a lot of suspicion. I mean, we saw it particularly with the question of British support for U.S. airstrikes in Syria, you know, which the House of Commons sort of came out and made a statement that they would not support the government going into Syria, even though the government technically can make its own decisions in terms of executive authority and what they do in Syria. Then there was a sort of, this summer, a big uproar when it became apparent that there were some British troops embedded in exchanges with American troops who were flying sorties over Syria. So there's a lot of anxiety about sort of being sucked into another American-led adventure or misadventure in the Middle East.
Associate Professor Laura Beers of the American University in Washington. Britain committed 45,000 troops to the invasion. 179 military personnel were killed during the conflict. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Scientists are looking at new ways of treating people who get malaria. The disease is caused by the one-celled Plasmodium parasite carried by a female mosquito. The parasite infects red blood cells, divides within them, and then eventually destroys the cells and escapes to repeat the process. Professor Mike Blackman is with London's Francis Crick Institute. He says his research team has discovered how the malaria parasite uses its own surface protein to break out of the blood cell. He says this is a significant finding, and he and his colleagues are looking at ways to keep the parasite bottled up in the cell. As he says, we think this is a discovery which will allow us to design new drugs which kill the parasite in a new way. The World Health Organization says there were almost 200 million malaria cases worldwide in 2013. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. It's long been said that dogs are man's best friend. For military dogs, they are even more than that, acting as guardian angels. Animal rights advocates in the United States say the country not only needs to take care of its veterans, but also the military dogs that have risked their lives on the battlefield. As we hear from VOA's Adriana Jung, some members of Congress are also joining the call to honor America's canine heroes.
At an event on Capitol Hill, organized by the American Humane Association, Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar says, it is important to strengthen the bond between soldiers and military dogs.
When you have the connection between a soldier and one of the dogs that he's been with, that actually has saved life, it's making sure that it's not only while they're in the battleground, but when they come back, give them the opportunity if they want to adopt that particular dog.
A majority in Congress wants retiring military dogs returned to U.S. soil and reunited with their former handlers. So does the American Humane Association, an animal welfare group. Every year, the American Humane Association selects military dogs, law enforcement dogs, rescue dogs, and others for their annual Hero Dog Awards. The Military Dog of the Year, a German Shepherd named Sergeant Rambo, served as an explosive detection dog with the Marine Corps and had a front leg amputated. Now he's the mascot of Gizmo's Gift, a nonprofit organization, and serves as an ambassador for K-9 members of the armed forces. The American Hero Dog of the Year, a Chihuahua named Harley, was abused in a puppy mill for 10 years and lost one of his eyes. Now he has become a symbol of saving abused pets. Axel, another German Shepherd, won the Service Hero Dog Award. His owner, retired Marine Captain Jason Haig, was diagnosed with brain injuries and stress after two combat tours. He credits Axel with helping him return to normal life.
These guys right here are life-saving and life-changing. So for somebody to abuse an animal, you're stopping somebody else from changing their lives.
The American Humane Association's Robin Ganzert says every hero dog has a unique and inspiring story.
These animals make us humans better.
Adriana Zhang for VOA News, Washington.
Chinese pianist Long Long is known for his virtuosity. He's the winner of multiple awards, performed with some of the world's top orchestras, and given concerts in front of millions of people. International Edition's David Byrd reports the Long Long International Music Foundation aims to bring the joy and the benefits of music to children worldwide.
The list of Long Long's accomplishments is itself inspiring. Playing at Carnegie Hall, at the 2014 World Cup concert in Rio de Janeiro, at the Grammy Awards twice, and at the opening ceremony of the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, Long Long has dominated piano for more than a decade now. His playing has also started a revival of piano studying in China with the Long Long Music World Arts Complex. But he still remembers how inspired he was by hearing great composers as a small child, and he aims to bring music to the lives of children around the world through the Long Long International Music Foundation.
Now we have a good team to develop a very good method, music education method, and we are giving those methods to selected schools, which we have a partnership with. So first we started two schools, one in Harlem a year ago, and then Boston 2 years ago. We are working with the kids, the children who start to learn music for the first time.
The foundation aims to pass on the excitement and passion for music that Long Long has. The Chinese-born pianist says his foundation offers students digital pianos with their teachers monitoring each student's performance in a classroom setting instead of one-on-one instruction.
At school, you have everybody play. They have a headphone on. So the teachers are almost like a DJ, you know, and multiple channels. Okay, I like to hear piano number 5. Can you play something for me? Now I want to hear piano 6 and 8 to play a duet for me. You know, so in this way, we are bringing music education really like a language training. So people can talk to each other through music.
Long Long started the foundation in 2008. Since then, he has tried to take music education to places it might never have been through partnerships with sponsors and through the help of the Grammys and UNICEF. In 2013, he was chosen to be a United Nations Messenger of Peace. The pianist says he hopes that through music, he can help people cross cultural and social divides.
I mean, music makes me a better person. Which, you know, brings me became a citizen of the world and, you know, traveling around the world, making friends all over the world. And, you know, hopefully we're, you know, making the world a better place through music.
Long Long is currently at the end of the U.S. leg of his latest tour. He will play concerts at Washington's Kennedy Center and then travel to France, Switzerland, and Britain by the end of November. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information right on our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During a recent congressional hearing, State Department officials described efforts by the United States and the international community to increase pressure on North Korea for its abysmal human rights record. State officials cited the comprehensive 2014 report by the UN Commission of Inquiry that lays bare a brutal reality. North Korea remains a totalitarian state that denies freedoms of expression, religion, peaceful assembly, association, and movement. An estimated 80,000 to 100,000 North Koreans suffer deplorable conditions in political prison camps where government officials commit human rights violations, including extrajudicial killing, enslavement, torture, prolonged arbitrary detention, rape, and forced abortions. In addition to the UN report, the United States has worked to amplify defector testimony in public forums around the world as a means of raising awareness of North Koreans who remain imprisoned. At the same time, the United States and the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights are working to document the human rights violations being perpetrated by the North Korean regime and hold those perpetrators accountable for their abuses. In an effort to put additional pressure on the North Korean regime, the United States has supported annual resolutions condemning the human rights situation in North Korea in both the UN General Assembly and the Human Rights Council. The mounting criticism of the North Korean regime's human rights record has had an effect, said Special Envoy for North Korean Human Rights Issues Robert King. With a growing number of countries condemning North Korea's human rights violations, North Korea has very few supporters left. The few countries that voted against resolutions critical of North Korea are among the world's worst human rights violators. King said the North Korean people deserve to hear the truth. That's why the United States continues to support the broadcasting of news and information about the world to North Koreans through radio broadcasts by Voice of America and Radio Free Asia. North Korea must address its egregious human rights violations. The choice is clear: investment in its people, respect for human rights, and concrete steps towards denuclearization can lead to peace, prosperity, and improved relations with the United States. Absent these measures, North Korea will only face increased isolation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours.